Shabbat Shalom. So this week's Torah portion, I selected very specific verses. And if you read before or after, you'll know that there's really just a wild range of mitzvot that are commanded and right next to one another. What they have to do with one another, nobody's completely sure. How they're arranged, there are lots of theories. But there are intensely, deeply ethical mitzvot sitting right next to ones that are that seem purely, even arcanely ritualistic. Although the last one that I read, that piece about not eating the roadkill, that just plain old makes sense. So, that said, I chose the verses that I did in order to emphasize a particular verse. And it's one that I find myself returning to again and again and again. And perhaps each year when I read this portion, as well as the several other Torah portions where this mitzvah comes from, it speaks to me in a different way depending on that year. And so I wanted to share a little bit on this mitzvah. V'ger lo toneh v'lo tilchatsenu, ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. You shall not oppress the stranger. You shall not put pressure upon them, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. This mitzvah, connected with the mitzvah that comes immediately after it, speaking of the orphan and the widow and protecting the rights of the stranger, the orphan, and the widow, is the most repeated mitzvah in all of the Torah. 36 times in total that we're told about that trio, stranger, orphan, and widow. But I want to focus in on this idea of protecting the rights of the stranger. And in fact, in Parshat Mishpatim, it comes two times within just a few verses of one another. Although, in order to get to the next repetition of it, I would have had to read considerably more Torah. So I chose to kind of cut it out. But I want you to hear actually the other way that it comes in the very next chapter, in chapter 23 of the book of Exodus. We're told, "V'ger lo tilchatz otam." V'ger lo tilchatz, you shall not harass the stranger. V'atem yedatem et nefesh hager. For you know the soul or the heart of the stranger. Ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. For you are strangers in the land of Egypt. So it adds in this idea of not harassing those who are strangers because you know what it feels like to be them. Not just were you strangers in the land of Egypt, but you know their nefesh. You know their soul, their heart. So I want to bring a couple of traditional and modern commentators and then maybe make it very direct in our lives, although I have a feeling that some of you hear where I'm going, at least in part, already. So Rashi is the greatest of all the biblical commentators, and even he needs to rely on earlier sources. So oftentimes he's quoting Midrash. He's quoting an earlier Midrash here. Rashi is answering a question basically like this. When we're told not to oppress or wrong the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt, what is the nature of that statement, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt? Not every mitzvah is explained. We're not told necessarily why to do or not to do anything in particular. In fact, it's the exception to the rule when we're told something like that. So what Rashi wants to know is, what is the force of for you were strangers in the land of Egypt? Is it to rationalize not oppressing the strangers, perhaps? In fact, on the face of it, that certainly seems what it looks like. But Rashi actually reads it in a completely different way. Rashi sees the phrase, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt, as a warning. Don't oppress the strangers. You were strangers, and when you start oppressing strangers, they're going to ultimately oppress you. Rashi's words, if you wrong the stranger, then they can come back and wrong you later, saying, you also came from strangers. Whatever deficiency is within you, don't accuse me of it as well. And the translator of that Rashi said, let not the kettle call the pot black. I don't think that's actually what Rashi said, although he was in France, it was a culinary culture, so maybe he had kettle and pot terminology as well. But in other words, it's a warning. Not just a rationalization of the mitzvah, but a warning. And you can hear that actually in, I heard a few audible gasps when I translated the next part where it talks about not wronging the orphans and the widows, because if you do, they'll call out to God and God will make your wives widows and your children orphans. That's as explicit of a threat as God ever makes in the Torah, I would say. But in the case of not wronging the stranger, Rashi reads it as basically a threat. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. If you wrong the stranger, it's not going to work out well for you. There was a commentator by the name of Nechama Leibovitz. She is less well known in America, but if you ask Israelis of just about every stripe, above a certain age, I guess, but maybe even below, who Nechama Leibovitz was, they will almost universally know. She was perhaps the most influential biblical commentator of the second half of the 20th century in the Jewish community. And we don't necessarily know her very well. Nechama Leibovitz was born in Germany. She was born into a fairly progressive and enlightened family. She was given university education, and she, along with her brother, Yeshayahu Leibovitz, who was also a great biblical commentator, they were both sent to university. And by the 1920s, she had already completed her doctorate in Hebrew Bible studies in Berlin. In 1930, she and her husband emigrated from Berlin to then Palestine, to Israel. And Nechama Leibovitz becomes really one of the most influential Bible teachers that the modern state of Israel has ever had. She taught everyone from the left wing, the ultra-radical left wing, to the ultra-right wing. She taught ultra-secular to ultra-orthodox. And indeed, her commentaries were printed in newspapers, were distributed as leaflets, and she had just a far-ranging influence. Across all of the denominations, people know Nechama Leibovitz. Before anyone listened to a woman who taught Hebrew Bible, Nechama Leibovitz was universally respected. So I want to bring to you what it is that Nechama Leibovitz writes about that Rashi, about how Rashi interprets, "You shall not oppress the stranger, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt." She translates the words a little bit, or maybe takes them into her own experience, maybe takes them into her own day and age. And I actually don't know when she wrote this commentary, because she wrote from the 40s through the 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s. And she just wrote volume upon volume of commentaries and kind of refined them over time. So Leibovitz writes it this way. She says, "Why is there a warning here about not treating the strangers poorly?" She writes, "The memory of bondage and exile is regarded here as acting as a protective shield against the evil impulse of overlordship and dominion. The temptation to exploit and oppress on the part of the self-supporting respectable citizen who himself was once a slave and an exile, and now wishes to lord it over those who are now strangers in his country." It's kind of very dense, and you can tell that she wrote her PhD in German, because her sentence structure kind of gives that away. But Leibovitz is saying, why? Why are we warned? Because we as human beings have an impulse. When we are the ones who are holding the power, our impulse is usually to use it over those who are powerless, particularly in this idea of who's a stranger and who is a landowner. She continues, "Because a history of alienation and slavery, the memory of your own humiliation is by itself no guarantee that you will not oppress the stranger in your own country once you've gained independence and left it all behind you. Do past memories and experiences of strangeness and slavery really prevail on and influence the newly liberated and independent to adopt an attitude of tolerance and love to the stranger living among them? Do we not often find the opposite to be the case? The hate, persecution, and shame of the individual or community experiences in the past do not act as a deterrent, preventing them from adopting the same attitude to those entrusted to their power later on." Again, it's very dense, but I think you heard within Nechama Leibovitz's words what she was saying. Those who are oppressed can easily, and through the evil impulse, as she would put it, can easily become the oppressor, particularly treating those who are going through what they themselves, or their parents, or their grandparents, or even their great-grandparents, what they went through, imposing it on others. Reading this commentary that was sitting in my files for years most certainly was resonant for me today. Resonant as an American, as a great-grandchild and grandchild of immigrants to this country. Resonant in the sense of the political moment that we live in, when it seems as though protecting those who are most vulnerable, and I don't want to make this entirely political, but thinking about those who are the DACA recipients who were brought here as children and have signed up to be fully contributing Americans who wish to help build this nation in the way that my great-great-grandfather and my great-grandfather and my grandfather came to this country and wanted to build our great nation, to think about the ways in which a nation of immigrants is maybe divided or maybe just politicized about just how we can do right, how we can fight off the evil impulse to do wrong. But I want to connect it as well to something that tears in my heart as one who loves the state of Israel and one who considers himself a fierce Zionist. Some have seen certainly in the news, and I'm never one to bring the warts of Israel into public, but I will tonight a bit. There is a fierce debate in Israel right now about the treatment of those who are asylum seekers, particularly African asylum seekers in Israel, and who the Israeli government has determined that that 20,000 of them are going to be forced out of Israel in the very short order, like in a matter of days or weeks, are going to be forced maybe back to the countries where they came from, predominantly Eritrea and Sudan, some from other countries in Africa, and perhaps maybe even some to third-party countries. And Israeli society is not as split as you might think. Israelis have a real difficult place that they're in because they are protecting themselves from a million threats from without. And trying to be a Jewish values-based democracy within, and sometimes it's in conflict with protecting themselves. But in this instance, I think that Nechama Leibovitz's caution is maybe very warranted. Last night, the Jewish community in the D.C. region, through their JCRC, released a statement towards the Israeli government. And it is a rare thing to see a broad-based coalition of agencies in the Jewish community, as the D.C. JCRC is, voice any criticism in this way. But I want to read and share just a little bit of what they said, because I think it's important to hear and important as we continue to wrestle with the ways in which Israel will be a Jewish democratic state, the ways in which it will wrestle to overcome the impulses that Nechama Leibovitz has so rightly identified. So the DCJCRC wrote this. In response to the Israeli government beginning to issue deportation orders to 20,000 individual Sudanese and Eritrean asylum seekers out of the approximately 35 to 40,000 currently living in Israel, the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Washington issued the following statement. The JCRC recognizes the right of every nation, including Israel, to protect its borders and ensure the safety and well-being of its people. Israel has unique security concerns and the challenge of maintaining its dual identities as both the Jewish homeland and a democratic state. Balancing these interests is no easy task. I'm skipping a little bit. Their suggestions, their push is this. A strategically and morally sound refugee and asylum policy for any country should include a transparent and efficient system for processing asylum applications so that claims are resolved in a fair and timely manner. Grants of temporary status to ensure asylum seekers' basic safety, stability, and dignity, including the ability to work legally and gainfully. And minimum standards for education, health, and welfare services for these asylum seekers. They conclude, finally, we urge the Israeli government to guarantee that any resettlement to third countries involve only those nations that are truly capable of and willing to absorb these individuals and ensure their long-term safety and status pursuant to the international conventions. It is a tug on the heart for someone who considers himself committed to a democratic and Jewish values-based state of Israel. I believe, and I am hopeful that that indeed the voices that are coming towards the Israeli government will prevail, and perhaps some resolution to this situation will come. That's that is short of simply turning people back and away. The last thing I want to share is actually a brighter moment of hope. And it came out of a meeting that I sat in this week. For a little bit over a year and a half here at Temple Isaiah, we've been talking and talking and talking about trying to help and aid those who are refugees, those who are asylum seekers here in our own community, in Howard County, in the greater Baltimore and D.C. areas. And this week, a small group of Temple Isaiah members met with a man named Salman Zaman, who is one of the heads of the Family Mentorship Program for the International Rescue Committee. The International Rescue Committee has been around since 1933. It was founded in part by Albert Einstein. And if you can think about Albert Einstein founding a committee in 1933, you can know pretty surely who the IRC was initially established in order to assist refugees like our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. And so Salman Zaman explained to us the way in which our community is going to be paired with a family, and a small core of individuals are going to provide them a few hours a week of English language, of assistance in the ways that they'll be able to get around the community, of companionship and friendship, and whatever else it is that they need. And it is one tiny little step. It is not the large step that I was hoping we would have taken about a year ago, but realities are what they are. But one step, God willing, leads to another step and another step. And so we work towards building the society that we wish to live in, and the society that the Torah very clearly teaches us we ought to be building. My prayer and my hope is that we will listen to the words of Torah, that we'll listen to the echoes of the generations that came before us and who sought refuge and asylum and who were indeed granted that, and that we will be the ones who give that to others. So I wish for everyone Shabbat Shalom, and that you should enjoy this Shabbat. And if you have interest and questions about that IRC project here at Temple Isaiah, you can talk to me at the Oneg. We'll be sharing out a little bit of that first step, and then seeing where that goes, whether we become a congregation with multiple families attached to us. That well may be as well. I want to invite Donna Kasoff, the president of our congregation, and as well, somebody who celebrated her birthday this week, onto the Bima for our announcement.